The Open Spaces Arts Festival, coming to Kansas City in just a few weeks, will have events and art installations all over town, but the hub of the thing is in Swope Park, and that's part of what makes it exciting. We have this huge park in our city, 1,800-some acres of park, and it's gorgeous. But there's so much of it that a lot of us haven't quite found a way to explore or enjoy, so why is that? They call it the crown jewel of the park system, and the glorious pavilion that greets you at the park's entrance suggests that it was supposed to be that, a special place for the city, a real destination. And maybe it's starting to be that. Starlight shows are popular, the zoo is a major draw, the soccer complex is awesome. But what's the story of Swope Park over the decades? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on KCUR's Central Standard. Dan Cameron is with us from the Open Spaces Festival. Hi, Dan.
Good morning, Gina.
What inspired you and your team to set up an artist's village in Swope Park? Why Swope Park?
Well, you know, it actually wasn't us. It was the mayor, Mayor James, when he created his proposal for a cultural festival. He wanted it centered in Swope Park. And I think the city council backed that by saying that neighborhood tourism development funds that had typically gone to institutions west of Troost could now be used to fund a culturally specific major arts signature event in Swope Park. So that was handed to me. And then I tried to do my due diligence in terms of research to figure out what Swope Park was. Remember, I'm not from Kansas City.
Right.
So I had to do a lot of poking around and asking questions and reading.
What did that reveal to you? I mean, especially as an outsider, I find that pretty fascinating.
It was very revealing. The first clue I had that something might be amiss was when people actually in the arts community said that they weren't sure that that was a very good idea. And I couldn't imagine why, because I'd been to Swope Park. I'd been taken on a tour of it. It's spectacular. I mean, I'm from New York. We have Central Park. So,
Central Park, which is less than half the size of this place.
Right. This is 2.5 times the size of Central Park. And an entire third of Swope Park, if I'm not mistaken, is not wilderness exactly, but it's unpaved. There are no trails. There are no services. It's reserve. It's protected reserve. But the reactions I was getting were very odd. And then I began to understand the east of Troost, west of Troost binary. And then I thought, well, why don't I just read into the history of segregation in Kansas City and see what role Swope Park played in that particular history and see if I can come up with some sense for myself of how people's reactions are in a way the continuing effects that segregation has had on Kansas City.
Can you spell out a little bit more of that reaction you were getting in the arts community, just talking to people about, and we're going to have this thing going on in Swope Park?
Are you sure it's safe?
Wow.
Are you sure it's... I don't think it's safe. It might not... People might not want to go there. Not me, but other people might not want to go there. It's always someone else is uncomfortable about Swope Park. And because I've kind of been interested in issues of racial dialogue and discourse for a long time professionally, I began to wonder if, since this is my first experience in a historically segregated urban environment, I thought, well, I need to start over. I need to set aside some of my assumptions about how keeping the races apart has functioned in the history of this country, and learn it from a different local perspective.
How has that been for you? Have you had sort of milestones in that education that you can share with us?
Well, someone, an artist in the community, said to me early on that the thing you have to understand about segregation in Kansas City is that it was very successful, and it was a business proposition. The way J.C. Nichols sold his developments was based on exclusivity. It was based on keeping your children in an exclusive environment and with the most desirable associations. I'm quoting actually from J.C. Nichols. And that idea that it was the job of the parent, or it was the job of the family or the neighborhood, to close ranks around people from other races was deeply, deeply embedded in the consciousness of all Kansas Cityans, whether you were black or white, but then, obviously the effects were different if you were black or white.
And then the consciousness, but then maybe generations later, subconscious?
Well, I think we have to look, maybe spend a little bit of time thinking about how desegregation, how the Supreme Court rulings, and then the way that real estate developers took advantage of that. Because you have to understand, it's not just about white flight. It's also about what they would call blockbusting, where you basically jam as many non-white people into a neighborhood as quickly as you can to freak out all of the white residents, get them to sell low, and get out before it was too late from their perception. So you have these weird instances where in 1 year, a parish east of Troost would go from 80% white to 90% African American in a 12-month period. And so that wasn't just people saying, I need to go. That was people being told by nefarious financial opportunists, maybe you should cash out and leave before it's too late.
Okay, I'm going to come right back to Dan Cameron from Open Spaces, but Daniel Cerda is with us. He's like kind of our go-to guy for all things urban planning and design. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
So what does the history that Dan Cameron is just learning as a newcomer to Kansas City, putting on a festival in Swope Park, what does it have to do with Swope Park?
I think what he's described is incredibly perceptive, because the thread that I think resonates most to me is this idea that there are ways in terms of how people even phrase things that they say that are reflective of much deeper, longstanding practices and vestiges of those practices. I think, you know, there are discrete events in the history of Swope Park specifically that relate to this, but I think it's also really important in two other contexts. One is that a large public space like Swope Park, especially a park, if you think about just the notion of park or public park, parks are actually fairly revolutionary in American cities, in the sense that, you know, the American city is, it's a capitalist enterprise, right? It's about the subdivision of what had been public land for private ownership and the development by private real estate interests of that land. And the notion, and this is a really fundamental part of the history of the parks and boulevard system in Kansas City, the notion that you would set aside land, not for development, but for essentially, you know, in principle, universal public use or public access, is actually pretty groundbreaking and was incredibly controversial at the time that it was presented. You know, you would say in retrospect, well, you know, who would ever fight the idea of a neighborhood park or a neighborhood playground? There were deeply entrenched business interests in Kansas City that fought tooth and nail to prevent the establishment of the parks and boulevard system for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was that to acquire parkland implied that local government was going to exercise eminent domain to take privately owned property and dedicate it to public use. So you have to start with that, you know, parks as a universally accessible public space, it's sort of a contested notion from the early history of parks throughout the United States. Then when you start peeling back the layers of our social history, of the tensions that have existed, especially racial and class tensions in American cities, parks become sort of a fulcrum for those disputes and debates.
Why?
And because, you know, if you start with the premise that this is publicly accessible space, then the moment that anyone raises a question, no matter how, you know, subtle or how egregiously the question is raised, that certain people maybe shouldn't be there, then that really throws into the fore a lot of underlying, very deep-seated assumptions about how society ought to function and how neighborhoods ought to work and how our city really operates. So you see this in a few different contexts. Let me give you a quick example. Department stores. A lot of people don't realize department stores, and again, we played out, you know, what are some of the seminal movements in the civil rights movement? The lunch counter protests, right? Where African-Americans came and sat at lunch counters that they weren't allowed to eat at. Or they went into department stores where they were only allowed to be in the department store on certain days of the week and that sort of thing. So those, you know, public spaces where these contests essentially play themselves out, and I don't say that to minimize it. I mean, it's about direct conflict in those spaces. It really pushes to the fore the underlying tensions that are there. And I think what Dan Cameron has said, again, is really important, is that the threads of those practices
And even some of the ways that the phrasing is placed, it's not me, but I'm concerned about other people. That actually is very reminiscent of the language that was used in the 1920s in court cases to justify segregation. It's not so much that we're trying to prevent African Americans or certain groups from being in a space. It's just that if they're there, that might create discord. And that might put them in danger. And really, our ostensible purpose in segregating spaces is to promote social harmony and prevent direct conflict in these kinds of public spaces. Remember, until Brown v. Board in 1954, the law of the land was separate but equal. So as long as there were separate spaces for members of different races, that was considered constitutional in the United States for nearly 50, 60 years of our history.
So, Daniel, you said that there are a few discrete events in the history of Swope Park mm-hmm. that really get at this. Can you quickly touch on some of those?
There are two nationally significant legal disputes that happened in Swope Park, one in the late 1920s and 1928, where two African-American men challenged the segregation of the Swope Park golf course. They were not allowed to golf at Swope Park, and they filed a legal challenge. And they did not prevail in that instance because of Plessy versus Ferguson and this idea of separate but equal. There are other facilities that you can use, not the one at Swope Park. And again, that was in the 1920s. The more profound one was in 1952 when a young NAACP attorney on behalf of some residents of Kansas City, including a woman many people have probably heard of named Esther Williams, filed a challenge against the segregation or the prohibition of African-Americans using the Swope Park swimming pool. And in that case, that young attorney, who happened to be named Thurgood Marshall, prevailed in the United States federal courts in a ruling that basically said, you cannot segregate these facilities. Now, again, just to explain how contested that decision was, the Swope Park pool was shut down for 2 years while that litigation proceeded. And again, the rationale for that was, well, there's too much risk of public discord while this issue is being litigated. For everyone's safety, it's probably better if we just close the pool. And again, not because we have any particular racial animus, but because there may
people
be broader
out there.
Sentiments out there among the public at large, and it's really to the benefit of both African Americans and whites that we just let's just not let this thing play itself out on the public stage. And again, that was a really profound, one of many in a sequence of legal decisions and legal victories for the NAACP that eventually culminated in Brown versus Board of Education. It's very much part of the pattern and the genesis of the entire civil rights movement in the United States.
Well, I want to bring in Eric Wesson, the editor of the Kansas City Call. He has personal memories of a lot of the history that we're talking about of Swope Park in his own lifetime. Eric Wesson, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I mean, talk to me about your experiences of Swope Park growing up.
Well, when I was growing up, you could go to Swope Park in the early 60s. You could go once a week on Sundays. And you could go to the swimming pool on Sundays.
When you say you, who are you talking about?
Me, well, black people in Kansas City, they could only go to, or we could only go to Swope Park, like on Sundays, and there was a area designated for us to go to. It was called Watermelon Hill. And
quite
we stayed
a term.
In that area, and we could go to the swimming pool then, and it would be so many people in there on that Sunday that you couldn't swim in there, even if you wanted to. So people just basically would just get in the water and just stand there and maybe jump up and down, but there was no opportunity to swim. If we did want to swim, we'd have to go to Greg Center or someplace down in the heart of the urban core, but it wasn't allowed to go any other day other than Sunday.
I want to just explain to our listeners really quick that, Eric, you are having an incredibly busy day, and so
absolutely.
We've got you the only way we can, by phone. But, yeah, if you hear Eric in the middle of his busy life there, that's what's going on. Eric, do you think that your history of Swope Park shapes how you relate to the park today?
A lot it does, and a lot of it is pretty much psychological, but you look back on the way it was and the way it is now, where is predominantly, the whole park now is predominantly black. And you go through the period of time of access to places like Freedom Incorporated started the lawsuit. So it was an accommodations issue. And from like 68 forward, it became more and more integrated. So today, I think you drive through there and you'd be kind of hard pressed, other than the Starlight Theater, to find whites anywhere in Swope Park, other than the soccer stadium in Swope Park. Now, that soccer stadium, that was the entrance into Watermelon Hill. Those were the basketball courts were over there. People had their picnics over there, family reunions when they were closed out on Sundays. All of those were in that area, and it would just go around toward the swimming pool when the swimming pool was in that part of that park.
So psychologically, does it feel to you like in some ways what you're describing is kind of a still segregated park in some ways?
It is, and Kansas City is still pretty much segregated. You know, it's just one of those things that we don't talk about. Certainly you can give the appearance that you can buy and you can use facilities wherever you wanted to in Kansas City, but there's that underlying subliminal segregation that still exists in Kansas City. And it's history on the plaza. I don't know of any black-owned business that's ever been in the plaza. And it's not very many that you can say have been on the west side of Main Street. I think Gates Barbecue is actually, the address is on Linwood, but on Main Street going west of Main, I don't think there's been any black businesses over in that area that have survived.
Eric,
so it is a lot of segregation here. People just don't talk about it.
I am a white person who's been somewhat sharing my own perception of Swope Park. And with you saying that, you know, your perception of the park, your experience of the park, where you go in the park might depend a lot on your race, can you give me another perspective on Swope Park?
Well, I know like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you would have blacks, and I guess they still do it today because I see a lot of cars coming out 63rd Street and going out Swope Parkway, where blacks would just go in what they call the circle in Swope Park, which is the Watermelon Hill area, and they just drive around through there. And on Sundays, it used to be so traffic jammed in there with people just driving through there. You would be sitting there literally for hours trying to get through the circle. And I think, you know, the golf course now, you have more and more blacks that'll play golf in that area now. And so it's kind of blacks have moved in and whites have moved out kind of thing.
What?
And in that area, somebody was talking about people living in that area. If you even go and look at Southeast High School back in the day when I was growing up, it was predominantly white, probably about 80, maybe even 90% white. And blacks would have the occasion of getting thrown in that fountain across the street in that circle, Myers Circle, get thrown in that park by white students there. And there would be a lot of racial fights going on during that period of time. So blacks couldn't live past 27th Street. Then it went to 47th Street. Then they, as we move further south, that's when the whole demographic of that area changed.
Eric, you know, I'm curious what you would like to see, like in your perfect vision of how the city would relate to Swope Park going forward. What would that be?
I think it should be something that would be inclusive for everyone, no matter if you're Hispanic, black, you're white, you're Asian. I think there should be something there that would attract every race and demographic in Kansas City. And I don't think that is there. And race is kind of one of the things that we really don't like talking about. We kind of think that if we just leave it alone, it'll go away and take care of itself. But having these type of conversations, I think, is the biggest thing that you can do, not only to kind of put a light on Swope Park, but as things take place in the community.
Eric
Wesson.
Can
I just say one more thing? I'm the senior staff writer. I'm not the editor.
Ooh, okay. Apologies for that. But thank you so much, Eric.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
What's been your experience of Swope Park over the decades, and what do you want it to be? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get to those calls in just a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we are talking about Swope Park, with a new ambitious art festival hoping to activate sections of that giant park. We're trying to get a sense of what Swope Park means and has meant to Kansas City over the years, and whether that's changing. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Daniel Serta with us from LISC, the Local Initiative Support Coalition. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Dan Cameron is the Artistic Director of Open Spaces, that arts festival we've been talking about, with a hub in Swope Park starting in August. Hi again, Dan.
Hi, Gina.
So we have talked a lot about the history of race in Kansas City and how that affects the way we see this park even today, sometimes perhaps without our even knowing it. And there's a time period that I'd like to dig a little deeper into, the 70s and 80s. And Eric talked about that time period. We just spoke with Eric Wesson of the Kansas City Call. He spoke about that time period a little bit from his perspective. My memory of that as a child, the 80s specifically, is that, you know, Starlight Theater was not the destination it is now completely. I mean, and I looked up online to kind of confirm this. They have a decade-by-decade history of Starlight Theater, and yeah, they were losing money during that time. Eric is describing that as a very vibrant time for the Black community in the park and its use of the park. And to me, I can't help but notice that.
Yeah. Well, that's also true with the zoo.
The zoo
would really sort of fall into, you know, the zoo was originally established back, basically at the front end of the Depression, and a lot of the facilities were actually constructed by the Works Progress Administration during the Depression. So, you know, by the 70s and 80s, those facilities were 40, 50 years old. There had been a lot of changes in how zoos are programmed and managed, and there had not been a lot of reinvestment in the zoo itself. That did not happen until the late 80s, early 90s, with, you know, major capital infusion and then reorganization of the zoo and a lot of other things. The same thing happened with Starlight Theater in the late 90s. And one of the things I recall from the 90s that was being discussed about Starlight was that the stage could no longer accommodate the scale of productions, whether it was concerts or especially Broadway-style shows, just in terms of the physical theater pieces, that would need to go there. So, you know, there's this pattern, and you're, I think, really putting your finger on it, that really plays itself out, especially in the 70s and 80s, where there's been a really dramatic, change in the composition, the racial composition of the neighborhood surrounding South Park and the user base of Swope Park, and then, just sort of the condition of the public facilities there. One other little important detail to mention, the entire phenomenon of Watermelon Hill was premised on the fact that African Americans were only allowed to use one shelter house in the park. That was shelter number 5, which is in the area that Eric was describing. And so naturally, there was only one area that African Americans were allowed to congregate. And during the period up until the 1960s, you know, the full throes of the civil rights movement, there was still a certain degree of separate but equal where, you know, the facilities were available to African Americans, but only even on certain days of the week, as he reflected. And to this day, there's still a pattern where, there are larger family gatherings on Sundays, for example, because historically it was only on Sundays that African Americans were allowed to use certain facilities in the park, like the swimming pool.
So another thing that I'm curious about, when you talk about that in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't reinvestment in Swope Park. Mm-hmm. Do you know how it's determined which parks within the park system get what allocation of funding? I mean, what?
Well, I mean, it's probably fair to say that the entire system needed reinvestment at different scales. And it wasn't until specifically the Cleaver plan during Mayor Cleaver, then Mayor Cleaver's administration, that a lot of public facilities, especially in the park system, saw really significant reinvestment. And there's been incremental reinvestment since then. The most dramatic recent reinvestment in Swope Park on the public side has been, 6 years ago, the introduction of the new Southeast Community Center within the park itself. It, you know, there was an earlier community center located around the corner. But, that was true of a lot of the, I mean, there are a lot of dimensions where you can look at the entire history of the city and the pattern of Y Flight and blockbusting that Dan alluded to earlier And, you know, kind of national economic conditions, a variety of things. There was a big retrenchment from investment in cities. That's when the cores of cities hollowed out. That's when downtowns declined. And I find it very difficult not to understand and appreciate that without understanding that simultaneous with all of that and precipitating a lot of that was the pattern of white flight and disinvestment from cities. Downtowns, for example, didn't just die. They coincidentally died within about 10 or 20 years of African-Americans being allowed to shop in all of the department stores. And so, you know, there's, you know, direct and indirect linkages between those. But, you know, it's part of a broader set of patterns in terms of disinvestment from cities and those social changes we've talked about.
So can I just back up and ask you about the original vision for Swope Park?
Yeah. The original vision of Swope Park is really interesting. There was always some concept of a large regional, what's referred to in landscape terminology as a pastoral park, sort of a natural preserve. But again, because there was so much business opposition to the entire idea of it, it seemed very unlikely. And the irony in the history of Swope Park is that Swope Park exists because Thomas Swope, this physician, donated the land less than a decade after he was one of the most vocal opponents to the entire establishment of the system. And, you know, at the time that the land was donated, you know, out south of 63rd, I believe the city limits might have been at not even to 20, maybe 23rd Street, not quite to 27th Street yet. So it was a donation of a very large tract, about 1,300 acres in the original gift, of land really far south of the city limits. But there's sort of a day of jubilee that happened that's documented historically. There was a public festival that was organized and a parade of Kansas Cityans out to Swope Park to celebrate the victory of having a large regional park as exists now. I mean, at the time, it was just a farm. It was just wilderness. But, you know, the crowd size was estimated. It was estimated that nearly 20,000 people, with every buggy and every conveyance that they could find, bicycles, whatever the case is, essentially assembled and marched from the heart of the city, which back then would have been in the teens and the 20s. And I'm talking streetwise, not yearwise. This is back in 1896. And essentially marched in procession out to the site of Swope Park to celebrate this grand victory of finally achieving sort of a European or Eastern city scale major park in the city.
Do you think, I mean, I'm curious about the larger symbolism of that and what you see maybe today in Mayor James apparently like really focusing some effort on putting an arts festival in this park.
Well, I don't know about the composition of the crowd at the time. I mean, it was more than 10% of the population of the city, you know, dropped what they were doing and went on to the population of Kansas City at the time is about 150,000 people. But it was a very large civic celebration. And I think that's something that I find really interesting in this idea of this particular project is that, you know, Swope Park, I've always seen it as, you know, a common ground for everyone to come together despite this history of segregation. When I think about my own childhood and the way you were reflecting and some of the most memorable experiences I have, I still remember what the original gates and stanchions looked like when you went to the entry of the zoo at Swope Park, because the first time I went there, I was probably 3 or 4 years old, and with, you know, every other year as a school trip or, you know, family outing, and was taken there. I remember, you know, the original African Veldt and the original monkey house, as they called it, and you know, all of the architectural features within the zoo especially. And I think we have to sort of consciously step back every now and then and think very constructively about how, as Mayor James has done in this instance, how we can do more to be not only self-conscious and aware about this history and the potential, but to really consciously bring ourselves together as a city and move beyond some of these things through these kinds of activities.
Dan Cameron, I want to get to our callers in just a moment, but I'm curious from you're not only a person from outside of Kansas City, kind of getting to know this park and getting to know this history, but you've also toured the park with national and international artists and witnessed their perceptions. And I'm curious what that might have revealed that would be very different, perhaps, from your conversations with the local arts community, people telling you, I don't know if you want to go there. I don't know if you want to do this in Swope Park.
Well, to a person, I have to say that the international artists and the national artists have responded really positively. Artists in general tend to love history because if they're being invited to do something site-specific, how they think of the specificity to the site is really important. And everybody, you know, most of the artists I'm comfortable with working with, if they're not entirely abstract artists, really do appreciate that process of knowing that they're not just making an artwork out of materials. They're also, in some way or another, shaping and forming how people experience public spaces. So there was a great deal of interest on the part of the artists. Even the ones who didn't, in the end, wind up making works in SWO Park, there are many artists who thought it was a fantastic idea and would have liked to had their practice been more appropriate.
Let's talk to Ernestine in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Ernestine.
Good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, I'm glad that you all are broaching this subject. I was glad to hear that you are going to be talking about this. And one of the questions that you all had asked Eric Wesson is, what would you like to see different or better about SWO Park? And I would certainly like to see the SWO Park Zoo made more affordable for families in Kansas City. I think the admissions fee right now is something like $15 or $20. And for a family of four, that could be very prohibitive. I think that the Kansas City Zoo would be a wonderful family outing, very educational, and yet I'm not sure that it is in the reach of all families in Kansas City.
And I guess I'm curious, within the context of this conversation, you know, we've been hearing that there's still kind of a subtle, at least, impression of segregation in SWO Park. Do you think that the cost of admission to some of the destination areas of the park is part of that?
Well, I think that it could certainly be a deterrent. What you all's intentions for the high cost of admissions, I can't really speak on. I do know that other major cities do make allowances for their citizens, you know, days that the cost is lower or the cost is higher for those who don't live in the area, you know, seeming to make some type of an effort to make these facilities available to their citizens.
Well, thank you, Ernestine, for that call.
Thank you.
You know, Daniel, a colleague showed me a mailing she got. There, Central Park in New York, this is a comparison we've made a couple of times. Mm-hmm. You can be a member of Central Park, mm-hmm. and that's a way that park generates revenue to yeah. do all the cool stuff they do there and mm-hmm. keep it accessible. Has the Kansas City Park System ever thought about something like that?
They absolutely have. The idea there is what's referred to as a conservancy. Now, Central Park is very, very unique in the sense that the conservancy there manages everything, and it is very, very heavily funded by private philanthropic donors as well as individuals. So it's a model that is very a little New York centric. But it is a model that in other respects has been attempted. There's a Penn Valley Conservancy in Kansas City, for example, I believe, and others have been attempted. The same model essentially has been applied, though, to the zoo and to Starlight. The zoo and Starlight are unique in that they were both started as public institutions, and they are now essentially privately managed philanthropic institutions in a large public park.
Dan Cameron, before we go, I mean, you talked sort of generally about the artists you've taken around SWO Park. Can you give us just one story about your experience in SWO Park with a visiting artist?
Well, it's probably the one I brought up last time, actually, Gina. Ebony Patterson, who's an artist from Jamaica, was the first artist to come to Kansas City for her field trip, and I had never worked with her before. So it was really an exciting opportunity for me to just establish this dialogue. And Ebony wanted... She was very interested in the story of the pool. She had researched the 1952 lawsuit, and she wanted to see the pool. So we took her there, and there's really nothing much to see. And she said, okay, can you take me to the Laguna? And we took her to the Laguna, and she said, this is really nice, but it's not quite what I'm looking for. Where does that road go? And it was the road that goes up to Go Ape. And so we took the road up to Go Ape, and she said, don't turn right, turn left. And at that point, I was thinking, we're going to the trailhead up there.
The hiking trail.
And she said, oh, good. No, I don't know. Let's just pull over here. And we pulled over and got out. And she said, what is that over there? And she pointed to the pool that was this hydrotherapy pool for children.
A different pool.
A small pool that had been overgrown and fenced and was an eyesore. It was officially something to avoid. to not look at. Don't think about this. Don't look at it. It's dangerous. And in that way, I think it became kind of a symbol of how race is kind of dealt with and talked about. And she said, I want to make this beautiful. I want to make this a space not of ugliness or something to avoid. I want to make it a space of contemplation, and I want to make it beautiful.
Dan Cameron, Daniel Serta, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Keep talking about Swope Park on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. In just a minute, the story of a Kansas City actress as she heads out of town. I'm Gina Kaufman. Meet Rashida Badajo on KCUR's Central Standard. That's next. Rashida Badajo has been called an actress on demand. That means she's someone with a strong enough reputation here in town that when roles open up, people think of her right away as a go-to kind of person. So it's got to be a tough pill for the theater community to swallow that this promising young talent who's made her mark here in the few short years since graduating college is headed off to New York City. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Rashida Badajo, better known as Roz, before she goes. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I am sorry to be meeting you just in time to send you off, but that must be exciting for you, if not for the theater directors in town.
It's a bittersweet thing. I mean, I've been in Kansas City my whole life, and so this is my first time, like, really leaving the nest, so to speak.
I want to get your personal story, but for people who aren't familiar with your work, let's talk a little bit about that first. You had a really breakout moment with your one-woman show, Young Black Victorian.
I did, which, like, there's so many things to say about it. Young Black Victorian is a one-woman or one-person show based on the life of Sarah Forbes Bonetta, who is a historical figure a lot of people don't really know about. She was this young Yoruba woman who survived ritual sacrifice by the stroke of luck, honestly, and became Queen Victoria's goddaughter. So,
did you feel in a way like you were creating a role for yourself?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, with at the time of which I created Young Black Victorian, it was a time of where a lot of people really didn't know me. And I've auditioned everywhere, and it's like, oh, Roz. And I'm like, okay, maybe you're funny. And I'm like, I'm more than just funny. And so Heidi Van, my mentor, who runs the Fish Tank Theater, tasked me with the option of writing my own show. And I bit onto it. And then the rest is history.
Another really impressive moment in your theater career is that one time when you were three different characters in a play about the Little Rock Nine.
Yes! The Nine Who Dared. That was my coterie debut. It was such an amazing experience and honestly one that I'd love to return to.
You are coming from a science background, which is maybe not what people would expect of the, like, rising star of local theater. Can you talk about science and its role in, you know, your family and your past?
Well, in high school, I used to joke that my dream job would be a chemical actress, one that I could fuse theater and science together to make a beautiful career for myself, like the best of both worlds.
You kind of do that a little bit, right?
A little bit. I used to be a mad scientist for a company called Mad Science, and I used my acting skills to do, like, school assemblies and such, and fusing that with my knowledge of chemistry to be able to inspire young children, specifically children of color, to venture off and try to chase their dreams of being scientists and actors and things like that.
But so your family, though, do I understand right that you come from, like, a whole family of Nigerian scientists?
Pretty much. my dad, who is now retired, which is crazy to think about, he has a degree in chemistry. My mom's a nurse. My sister's a nurse practitioner. My uncle is one of the head chemists of Johnson & Johnson. So it was kind of like set out for me that, yeah, you're going to be a chemist probably. And I'm like, yeah, it's what I love. And it didn't really turn out that way.
What changed your path?
Honestly, ever since I was a kid, I loved music. I loved dancing and performing. High school, I started getting into plays and such and thinking it'd be a really nice hobby. And then senior year of high school, I saw the Broadway traveling tour of Wicked and I sobbed. And I knew at that very moment that this is what I really wanted to do.
Was that a hard realization for you, or was it sort of like, understood that you could go in your own direction. I mean, I don't come from a family where everyone pursues like a single vocation in that way.
Well, it was a hard realization, and it's kind of one that my dad was like caught wind of, because he's like, well, you keep getting these awards for like acting and such, so are you sure you want to be a chemist? And I'm like, yeah, Dad. I mean, I have to like feed myself. Like,
fair enough.
But I being a child of immigrants, I realized that my family had to settle. And the great part about being a first generation Nigerian American here is that I have the option of not to settle.
Can you explain that they had to settle?
It's kind of like it is a huge Nigerian trope. It's honestly a fact that a lot of, if anyone's Nigerian is listening, will be like, yep, this is true. You have three jobs. You can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, or you can be an engineer. Those are your three options. And it's because of survival.
And so you feel that you have this other set of options beyond those three because of being born in America?
Yes, absolutely. Being born here, it has a lot of privileges, being able to go to public school for free and also being able to be exposed to so many different things. And also growing up in the 90s, while seeing a lot of black people on TV was like, oh, that's an option for me. So representation is extremely important. And I don't know, there's something about helping people in one way or another, and theater's that way for me.
Can you talk about you talked about going to public school. Were you a product of the public school system here in Kansas City?
Yes. I went to Hickman Mills High School. I was actually the last graduating class of 2010. Go Cougars. and that shaped my worldview kind of in a way. People have a lot of bad things to say about our quote urban schools and such. And in reality, Hickman was cool. We didn't really have bullies per se. Everyone, like the jocks, were friends with the geeks and such. We kind of was like this giant family. So it was really helpful stepping out into the world to be like, you know what, we can be a big community. We don't have to fight. So.
And that's where you started getting into theater?
Yes.
Can you tell me about the theater program there?
Well, it's such a strange like thing. Our plays would be in the small theater called the Little Theater, and Hannah Cusick and Paul Hackenberger were the main people that kind of helped run that. They also ran the competitive drama team and the debate team, of which I was both a part of as well. And it was pretty cool. I mean, we got to play a bunch of different roles. At like, my last role was Sharpay in High School Musical. So like, typically different roles for African-American students and students of color that you traditionally wouldn't be cast as, you had the opportunity to do that. So
what do you think that did for you as a budding young actress?
It put into perspective for me what my capabilities are. So I wasn't really hindered by, oh, you're a black girl, so you can only do X, Y, and Z things. Like, no, you can be a traditionally blonde white woman and still like deliver a decent show. So
do you think, I mean, there was a statewide competition that kind of sealed the deal for you, right?
I'm like, maybe.
And when I've been reading up on you, and one of the things I found out is that you had a drama teacher who kind of encouraged you to send in some recordings of yourself, and that you were selected as like one of just a few people in the state of Missouri to participate in a statewide program.
Yes, Missouri Fine Arts Academy. It no longer exists. So I was also the last class of that program that was funded by the state. So for a long time, it was at Missouri State University, and for 20 days, all these students from all over the state of Missouri, from different artistic backgrounds, would train with college professors to be able to hone their craft, which was mind-blowing.
What was mind-blowing about it for you?
I mean, I got exposed to different forms of theater and theater creating that I didn't even know existed. So that just opened so many doors when it came to the type of art that I could do with theater.
What has it been like for you to forge a career for yourself in Kansas City since graduating from college? You went to Longfellow?
Oh, I went to Longview, got my associate's degree, and then I transferred to UMKC, and I graduated in 2015 with my degree in theater. Well, it's been hard, but fun. It's challenging. I love a good challenge, but I've been blessed to have a lot of really good people in my corner to help me when I feel like I can't do it or things like that. Heidi has been a really huge person in my life to be able to help me build a strong foundation for my career.
What do you hope to gain in New York?
Everything. Honestly, my end goal is to be an artistic director for New York theater. That is my end goal. And I feel like this move will help expose me to different networks to be able to learn how to better make art, bigger communities to be able to deal with and challenge myself physically, emotionally, mentally, all of it. And well, if you want to be on top, why not go to New York?
I mean, it sounds like you are really dreaming big, and I admire that. Do you see a lot of that in Kansas City? Or I guess, yeah, what's it been like for you to be a person who dreams big in this community?
Kansas City is full of nothing but big dreamers. I think people have a tendency to underestimate what is Kansas City. I mean, we have the second largest theater per equity member per capita next to New York, which is insane. So like people can actually like make a living and do theater here, which people don't expect. Nothing but cutting edge theater, even really beautiful classical theaters. I mean, I've had the privilege to work with a lot of different theater companies here in town, and there hasn't been a show yet that I've done with a professional theater company that I felt was a waste of my time. Big dreamers, we dream big.
You've got a play that you've been working on with teens that's opening this weekend. Is that your last gig before you go?
That's my last official gig. The project is with the Summer Youth Theater Ensemble, which is with Kansas City Repertory Theater. This is my second year, and the second year of its iteration. The play is called Louder Than a Bell, and we have 24 students from 19 different schools, including two homeschoolers, who spent the entire month of July with us learning how to devise different forms of theater, playwriting, acting skills, all of these different skills to be able to come up with their own brand new show that opens this weekend. Ah!
Tell me about the show. Tell me about what they've put together and how you've guided them through it.
Well, it's not just me. I also have a bomb team, a super bomb team. We have Deanna Mastra, Andy Perkins, our fearless leader, Lydia Fuque, and Mindy. She's just Mindy. Yes. And so when I say Mindy, everyone's like, oh, we know Mindy. And we all have different backgrounds when it comes to theater making. And we have worked by teaching them different abstract forms of theater with like movement. We've done a lot of improv work in training, Stanislavski work, a little bit of Meisner. We're really pushing these kids to be able to dig deep within themselves and show the world their truths. So this play is really, it looks at the lives of teenagers through the course of a school year and in different seasons from fall, winter, spring, and summer. It's like a giant hero's journey, but from the perspective of 24 very different individuals.
And I hear that you will rep KC till you die.
Till I die. Every time I go on vacation, I always wear my Royals jersey. So they're like, oh, you're from KC? I'm like, abso-friggin-lutely. And your barbecue sucks because KC has the best barbecue.
What are you going to miss most about Kansas City generally and like the theater community here in particular?
There's just a sense of familiarity here. I'm going to miss the grid system. I'm going to miss the barbecue. I'm going to miss the friendly faces. I have friends that have moved from Kansas City and that live on the coasts, and they complain to me about how people just aren't polite. So I'm going to miss that the most.
You're going to miss politeness?
Politeness.
Man, we should have had you on our conversation about Kansas City Nice. You would have been a dissenting voice. Well, Rashidat Badajo, or Roz, to your friends, good luck in New York, and thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much.
That's a wrap for today's show. Go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today for anything you might have missed and still want to catch. kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you'll find our list of great books about life in the suburbs. Our bibliophiles had a lively conversation about that on Tuesday. We also spoke about Swope Park earlier in today's show. Tomorrow, a portrait session with a young adult novelist by the name of Adib Karam. He grew up feeling like an outcast, struggling with depression in his Gladstone, Kansas City school. He's written all of that into his book, Darius the Great is Not Okay. More on that tomorrow at 10. Today's show was produced by KCUR's Coy Duggar. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. They've got Bernie Sanders, so stick around for that here on KCUR.